Welcome back to another episode of Life Sutras. I'm your host, Antral Bhatia, coming to you from Sydenham Clinic. I am the founder and CEO here, but more importantly, this podcast today is in my capacity as managing trustee of Breathe Easy India and Breathe Easy USA. Some of you may be aware of the global crisis that's happening because of the second wave of COVID-19, and India, unfortunately, is the worst affected. I have with us two renowned doctors who are frontline physicians, been at this disease at, you know, in the middle of the pandemic for the last over a year. Dr. Satinder Kaul.
Surinder.
Sorry. Cut. cut. Okay. Dr. Surinder Kaul, who is the medical director of Baylor College of Medicine. There is a hospital in Sugarland where he's called CHI St. Luke's, where you're the medical director, but he has been the medical director of Bentop Hospital, which is the main teaching arm of the Baylor College of Medicine for over 11 years previously. He's also the teaching faculty at Baylor College of Medicine. And we have Dr. Nishat Latif, who is a board-certified emergency medicine physician. She is also one of the only 1,500 board-certified IFM-trained physicians in the world. And we're very fortunate that Dr. Latif is joining our team here at Sydenham Clinic and will be looking after our members. She is an ER frontline physician who has been a medical director of different ERs and also been very involved in COVID. Dr. Kaul is extremely, you know, passionate about what's going on in India today from many points of view, but he's part of the global Kashmiri Pandit diaspora where he's doing a lot of work. And I just want to put a disclaimer out there. Today, our goal is to empower you to be the CEO of your health. We want to alleviate the fear. We want to reduce the panic. There are many things we can do in our individual capacities if we get infected or if a loved one gets infected with COVID-19. We're not giving you medical advice. We are not paying you to say this. Please understand this is being given out in public interest. And we're just doing this, you know, as a service today. So with that, I'd like Dr. Kaul to please explain what is this crisis and what's going on.
Thank you, Anshul, for inviting me. It is a privilege and my pleasure to be here. Before I make any comments, I would like to reiterate that a disclosure that I'm not being paid for this service. This is a medical advice based on the humanitarian crisis, and I'm doing it on my personal capacity. My institution is not involved in it, and in good faith, keeping in view the alarming situation which is evolving. It's true that COVID-19 pandemic has been there for last 1 year, and we have seen that almost all countries have been affected very, very badly. And we have had first wave of COVID-19, especially being in US, we have seen the worst. And we are now seeing second wave in certain countries and third wave in some countries. Now, India is struggling in this second wave. They did fairly well in the first wave, but second wave is really impacting and threatening human lives. So COVID-19, there are also lots of misconceptions because there's a lot of knowledge and it is adding to the confusion. As a scientific fraternity, as a medical fraternity, I would like to inform the audience that, you know, it is an unknown disease which has been here for last 1 year. So there are lots of unknown yet, but in last 1 year, we have studied and we have understood a lot of behavior of the viruses, this particular virus. And we have also seen what is working, what is not working. So I will just navigate about you to alleviate, this may alleviate some anxiety, the fear in your minds. First of all, it's true that COVID-19 is very contagious. Now, 81% of people who are affected with COVID-19 infection, they can be either mild or they can be moderate. So this 81% of the population, almost, to a larger extent, can be managed within the comfort of the homes. So there is a lot of panic that anybody who is being diagnosed with COVID-19, he or she is rushing to the hospital because of the fear. But I hope this podcast will be very helpful to you, that 81% of the patients who are mild to moderate symptoms, they don't need to rush to the hospital, and I'll be talking about the warning signs when they need to go to the hospital. So first of all, the symptoms. You know, the common symptoms of COVID-19 can range from fever, which can be high grade with chills, body aches, sore throat, cough. And we have seen that the studies have shown that it impacts the sensation of smell, the sensation of taste. And then some patients can also have diarrhea. So these are the common symptoms. And the incubation period of the disease is somewhere around 14 days. But most of the patients who develop COVID develops it within 4 to 8 days usually. So what to do when you have these symptoms? So most of the patients who don't have any comorbidities like diabetes or underlying cancer, you will do fairly well. There are certain exceptions to this, but most of you will do fairly well. And there is most of the patients with COVID-19, there are different scenarios. I know there are lots of treatment protocols that steroids help, remdesivir helps, convalescent plasma help, but there is also lots of misinformation that everybody is running towards getting the antibiotics, getting steroids. These are the medications, and every medicine has specific indication. So let us take one by one, if you permit, Anshul.
Yes, please. That's exactly what's happening. People are hoarding medications. There's counterfeit medication that is being sold in India. And everyone is sending out hundreds of WhatsApp messages. I need remdesivir. I need plasma. Does everybody really need it? And who needs it and who doesn't?
Yeah, it's a very good question. As I said, most of you who are well, they contain COVID. They get fever. They get body aches. It's fine. I would suggest that every family, which has turned out to be beneficial, is to monitor your oxygen levels. Oxygen, oxygen, oxygen. So we get pulse oximeter, which is readily available and it's not expensive. And any COVID patient who is being diagnosed with COVID should test his oxygenation levels 3 to 4 hours, every 3 to 4 hours. And see how is it. Now, there is again a misconception, miscommunication, misinformation about oxygen. Everybody thinks that, oh, my oxygen level is 98%. So their impression is that the oxygen has to be 100%. And that's not the case. Any oxygen above 90 or 92% is absolutely okay. And body can cope up very well with that. So if you have COVID and you have oxygen saturation of 97%, you are fine. You don't need to take any antibiotics. You don't need to take any steroids. You don't need to take anything. Just wait and watch, but take precautions. Important thing which supersedes everything is that you isolate yourself. If you have symptoms, even if you have not got tested, please isolate yourself immediately. And what is that isolation? Preferably go to a separate room, use masks, and the household members should wear masks and maintain strict social distancing. Now the question is, do you need to be tested for it? I know in pandemic there's a lot of crunch, there's a lot of pressure on the healthcare system. Maybe you may not get a turn to get tested, but you don't have to wait for the test. In a pandemic, if these are your symptoms, unless proven otherwise, it is COVID-19. So in the absence of the test, just isolate yourself. But yes, whenever you get an earliest chance of testing yourself, please do that.
Yeah, and I just want to bring up one thing, which is that the rate of false negativity of tests, right? Is also very high. So even if you do end up going and getting tested, if clinically, I always say if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck, right? So if it looks like COVID and acts like COVID, as far as I'm concerned, it's COVID. So I think that there's a, you know, there's sort of a gray area, and the safest thing to do is assume you have COVID and take proper precautions.
I fully agree with you, absolutely. With this, now there are different scenarios, what to do. What are the warning signs that your dad is there, your mom is there, your sister is there, your wife is there, you are there. So what are the warning signs that you should be alarmed and you should seek medical intervention? So the symptoms that I talked to you about, fever, body aches, these are the immune, these are the inflammatory responses to any infection. That body has its own self defense mechanism. So it is using, the body is capable of formatting an immune response. So this is good. So nothing needs to be done. You don't need any antibiotics if your oxygen saturations are 94-95% and above. In specific cases, it may be slightly different. We can discuss that. But if it is that, you don't have any comorbidities, you are good. Alarming signs. If you have persistent shortness of breath. Shortness of breath is definitely one of the signs, and persistent. We may become short of breath because we have anxiety. But no, if there's a persistent shortness of breath, that you are doing a activity you were doing without any issues in the past, and now for last some days you are feeling that doing this small activity is making you short of breath, yes, first please do check your oxygen frequently. And when I say check your oxygen, it is not at rest. I have seen many patients whose oxygen saturation at rest can be 96%, 97%. And when they are talking, to me or to their physicians, their saturations come down. It comes to 93, 92, 91, 90, 88. So important thing is that check your oxygen also when you walk for 5 to 6 minutes. That is actually the actual oxygen reading that will help you.
That's
now,
a great point.
Yeah, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think it's also important to acknowledge what your mental state is when you're checking your oxygen, because if you're hyperventilating and you're extremely anxious, you know, there's a potential that it could throw off your read. So you really just want to make sure that you're in a controlled and calm state, and as you said, have some mobility while you're checking your oxygen for sure.
Right. Another important thing is oxygen. So oxygen is a number game. Now, if your oxygen is, I must say, you know, there are different studies, but because we are talking about the common people, and maybe you may not have access to a physician because physicians are busy dealing with the pandemic. So what I would suggest that if your oxygen levels are persistently dropping, whosoever it is, your father, mother, any of your loved ones, if it is dropping, and if it's dropping around 94%, usually we see 92% and below. But for keeping a window so that a patient doesn't drift towards the severe disease, it's important that you maintain 94% and below and seek medical attention, all right? But not in the way that you start running towards the hospital, but check out that, is it that available? Because in that process, you are doing more harm to the patient if he has such a situation. So that is important about oxygen numbers, importance about the warning sign of shortness of breath. So these are the basically 81% will be categorized to this category with mild to moderate symptoms. Then we have 14% of the patients who are categorized as severe COVID infection. And these are the severe COVID infections who need to be in the hospital. And then we have 5%, 4 to 5% of the patients who are critical and those who need to be in the ICU. So why I'm saying this is please do not have panic, because panic makes things worse. Have a positive outcome of this infection if you deal intelligently, cautiously, and take all the steps, you will escape. For an example, I have been dealing with COVID patients for the whole year, And I have been going, seeing them in the ICU, seeing them on the medical floor, and in very, very close proximity. But we use gowns, we use face shield, but I have not got COVID infection. So that is a positive note that if you do certain things carefully, you will definitely escape and defeat this virus.
Which brings a very interesting point, because a lot of people are declining and landing up in a situation where they need hospitalization or ICU beds because of lack of care. And parents are left to fend for themselves, who can't do anything and they don't know how to do it. So they're just bedridden and they're falling more sick. So how do you look after a loved one who's got COVID and you're living in the same home? Can Dr. Lateeb and you maybe, you know, tell us how you do it? Because you're frontline too in an emergency medicine environment and you're around patients all the time. So how can we look after a loved one?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And there's some, and some of those answers are so basic, right? They seem so basic that it's almost counterintuitive. And I think people forget about the basics. People forget, for instance, that our bodies are mostly made of water. And water is an essential part of every cellular functioning process and every biochemical process. So something as simple as encouraging your family member to drink water. How much? A general rule of thumb is half of your body weight in pounds, in ounces, is how much water you need to drink to maintain proper hydration for all of the essential organs. Movement. Movement is such a critical part of recovering and healing during the inflammatory process, because COVID is essentially an inflammatory insult on the body, right? And so if we can supply our bodies with the hydration and nutrient, vitamin, and mineral intake that is needed to support our cellular function, we're going to recover a lot quickly.
So don't just lie flat in bed if you're diagnosed with COVID-19.
Absolutely.
Keep walking
not.
In your room, keep
yes.
moving. That's essential.
Yes. If you have stairs, go up and down stairs. That's a great way to get things moving. And also remember that if you have COVID, there is an association with becoming hypercoagulable, right? So there's an increased association with things, for instance, like clots. How do you prevent them? You keep moving. If you're going to stay in one place, then the chances of you having complications from COVID are going to get a lot higher. If we keep moving, whether it's walking around, and the thing is, the studies that have looked at movement and its correlation with chronic diseases like COVID, we're not talking about you having to go and do a serious workout. We're talking about just, you know, just push yourself a little bit. You're walking a little bit faster than normal, then go slow. And if you can alternate between moving fast and moving slow, you're actually really exercising your cardiovascular health. So those are just a couple of
things. What about breathing
things.
Exercises?
Breathing exercises are amazing. And
even if I have COVID.
Even if you
and
have
I'm
COVID.
Sick and my saturation is in its early 90s,
yes.
Should I be doing it?
Absolutely. And breathing exercises have so many benefits. One is we inflate the lungs, right? So we're filling the lungs up with air and deflating them. And not only does it actually serve your lung capacity and keep your lungs fully and physiologically inflated, but it also, you know, it also works with our parasympathetic system and decreases stress. And decreasing stress in the process will also decrease inflammation, which is also going to help the body heal. So one of my simple things, it's a very simple way of breathing, is 4-7-4. Mm-hmm. So you inhale for 4 seconds, you hold it for 7, and then you exhale for 4. And if you can do that rhythmically several times, it actually will help, you know, maintain your lung capacity. It will help increase your oxygen intake. And it will also decrease stress. And it's like a form of meditation.
So this is great. I know there's lack of oxygen out there, but we can take simple steps to make sure our lungs are at least taking the adequate oxygen that's available, you know, at room temperature or atmospheric oxygen. So please, you know, take note of these small things that we can do. So oxygen is the first one. Now, the second thing about the treatment, the different medication that's out there, the shortage that's out there. How do we go about that situation? Like remdesivir was one.
Yes, There's also, before I touch remdesivir, the antibiotics, role of antibiotics, when to start steroids. Now, steroids has a specific indication. It's a wonder drug. It's a life-saving. It has been shown to decrease mortality. And the indication of steroids is that if a patient, there can be different scenarios. Please check with your physician. Steroids, patient with COVID-19 infection, who has these symptoms and perhaps his CT scan might be showing some ground glass opacities and his oxygen saturation is going below 92%. Actually, that is the recommendations and guidelines. But you know, there are still, we use differently, somebody is using steroids even if it goes below 94%. So that's okay. So don't use steroids when your oxygen saturation is 98% and your imaging studies is showing pneumonia. So use that. This is what has been studied. And this is the recommendations that use steroids only if your oxygen saturation drops 92%, but you can just keep a window of below 94% as well. Second is the role of antibiotics. You know, if you belong to mild and moderate, perhaps you don't need antibiotics. Antibiotics, you know, is but natural that it's a viral infection. Why do we use antibiotics? Now, the studies have shown that we see the example from influenza, the flu. The most of the deaths are because of the super-added bacterial infections. And we are pretty sure that many of the patients of COVID infection might be having a super-added bacterial infections. But again, we use antibiotics in a hospital setup where the patient is more sick. So there is no added advantage of using antibiotics when the patient belongs to with minor or moderate symptoms. Maybe some selected cases of moderate symptoms can have antibiotics. What I'm trying to say that by and large, you don't need steroids, you don't need antibiotics, provided unless you meet some criteria.
A lot of times you get hospital acquired infections as well, and that's one of the reasons why they give you antibiotics in a hospital setting. So if you're isolated and you're fine at home, you don't need to start medication, because I'm seeing there's an urgency. Oh, I've got COVID, I need to start medication.
I would like to make a small correction here. When we talk in terms of viral, say for example, we are talking about influenza, that's also a viral disease. But the most mortality of influenza is because of super-added bacterial infection.
And you can get it at home as well?
No, not at home. These are selected for selective sick patients who are in the hospital, who have other markers and other things that qualify. But by and large, there is a proper indication of starting antibiotics. And we also think that there are a lot of super-added infection with COVID-19 pneumonia as well. So we are using, but it is for the sick patients, sick and critical patients that we are using. But selectively, some portion of the moderate symptoms, we can use it. But what I'm trying to say that it doesn't have any role in random that you have COVID-19, you start antibiotics, you start steroids. So that is what I'm trying to clarify. There are certain special situations like remdesivir, convalescent plasma, and the monoclonal antibody tocilizumab that is being used. But for the information of general public, you know, these medicines are for select patients with select indications. Again, it's not that you have COVID and now this remdesivir is a magic drug, or convalescent plasma is a magic drug, or tocilizumab is a magic drug that we need to go around. I'm saying this with reference that there has been a lot of hoarding, lot of shortages of remdesivir, and a lot of volunteers are running around, my patient is sick, I need a plasma donor. So remdesivir has been used in select patients who are severely sick, and there is a small window. We try to use remdesivir. It has not shown any benefit over the mortality, but it is being used because there are still some studies that are still going on, but there is a narrow window where we use it, and in those windows we need to use in a very timely fashion. Same is the case with convalescent plasma. Maybe you may get upset, but because I can understand your situation, because your loved one has COVID, he is sick, and you want to do everything possible so that you don't have any feeling of guilt. But you need to understand that we practice evidence-based medicine. And convalescent plasma, again, is also meant for certain section of COVID-19 infection who are in the hospital, not at home. Similarly, tocilizumab, monoclonal antibody for sicker patients, not for everyone to take. So that is about the medications.
What about you in your ER? Like, what are some of the general protocols? Is there like a blanket protocol you follow for every patient? Because in India, I feel that's what's happening. Everybody gets on Favi-flu, Tamiflu. They get on some doxy something. They share their prescriptions. Oh, you have COVID? Here, take my prescription. Start the medication.
Yeah, absolutely not. There is no blanket protocol. In fact, I would be inclined to say that probably most of my patients, I do nothing. I tell them go home, take over-the-counter medications like ibuprofen and Tylenol to bring down your fevers and give you some symptomatic relief of your symptoms. But most of the patients that come to the ER are not in need of anything more than just that. And I also, just tying back to what you were talking about, Dr. Call, about, you know, the steroids and the antibiotics, is that none of these medications are completely harmless. I mean, I think that's the other thing that it's really important for our listeners to understand, is that steroids and antibiotics and all of the, and remdesivir and all of these monoclonal antibodies are not benign medications. Meaning, if you take them when you don't need to take them, you can actually be harming your body. And I think that's a really critical thing for people to really understand and absorb. Because I'll give you a simple example of an unnecessary antibiotic really impacts our gut microbiome. And a large part of our immune system lives in our gut. And so we're essentially compromising our immunity by taking antibiotics unnecessarily. So I would urge all of our listeners and everybody to only take antibiotics as directed by your physician. Don't take a family member's medication. Don't run out and try to get a medication without proper medical direction.
I may add, with your permission, you know, we said that the physicians in India are following different protocols. You know, I want to set the message right. You know, Indian physicians are one of the best physicians. They are very smart physicians. It is the nature of the disease. You know, at one stage, because this is a new disease and studies are still going on, every country might be having some different protocols here and there, and same is true with India as well. I remember that when we were in the middle of the crisis and in the beginning, there was a lot of hype about the role of chloroquine. And everybody saying, why don't you give me chloroquine? It is for prophylaxis. But it becomes an issue, because evidence-based is something different than creating a hype about a medicine which doesn't fulfill that criteria. Mm-hmm. Similarly, there are certain situations where in India they use ivermectin, they use other medications. At this stage, as a physician, maybe the studies show later on that they may work. But as of now, there is no significant, there is no guidelines to use them. But that doesn't mean in any case that the physicians in India are not smart. They are pretty smart.
No, the physicians are smart. Patients share their own prescriptions. So in India, I can take my sister's prescription and go and get medication, and I start taking the medication without consulting a doctor. So, you know, that happens very often where you don't see a prescription. You say, okay, my aunt got it. I'll start taking the same medications as her.
Yeah, yes. I wanted to clarify so that the wrong message doesn't go.
No. Our physicians are working tirelessly. They are doing their best, I know. But very often we don't seek a consultation and we just go and jump in and start following, I'll follow your prescription.
Mm-hmm. And that happens here too. I mean, it happens in the U.S. all the time.
Here it's harder to get medication. Yeah. In India it's a little easier to get medication because it's not centralized medical records. Mm-hmm. Can we now talk a little bit about, again, understanding what is this variant? What's going on? What is this mutation? Is there going to be a third wave? Dr. Lateef, can you shed some light on that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So viruses mutate all the time. It's a natural part of evolutionary biology, right? And when viruses mutate, sometimes they become weaker, and sometimes they become stronger. And if they become stronger, it essentially means that they can proliferate faster and perhaps cause infections at variable rates. And I think the the biggest thing that is going on are people are getting very frightened about these mutations. And the reality is that this virus is never going to stop mutating. And that is just a fact of reality, right? I mean, the flu virus mutates every year. That's why we all get vaccinated with a flu shot every year, because it changes. And so essentially, when we're creating these vaccines, we are the CDC is basically making a prediction of what strains are potentially going to be the most impactful in a given year, and they create the vaccine based on that information. My hypothesis is that is probably the direction that we're heading with COVID, and that this is going to just be a part of our life. But hopefully it will get to the point where it's well controlled, just like the flu is controlled. So this new variant, which is called the B.1.617, the thing about it, which is the Indian variant, is that it's basically a double mutant. Okay, and there's two different mutations. The first mutation is very similar to the mutation that was found in the UK, the South African, and the Brazilian variant. The second mutation was actually the one that was first seen in California. And let me make a little correction. That first mutation is similar to the one that we saw in South Africa, Brazil, and in the UK. Not exactly the same. But essentially, the first mutation is what we call an escape mutation. And that is why this is causing such havoc in India. And they use that terminology to describe a mutation or a type of virus that can essentially escape the immune system, so that when people are infected, the virus has a way of sort of dampening our immune response. And that is the reason that this is such a frightening strain, and that is the reason that the rates are so astronomical. I mean, India has set a global record, right? I mean, they've been on a 6 or 7 day streak, and yesterday was the highest, 361,000 new infections, and I think about 200,000 people have died. So it's quite frightening. But these are
very, very conservative numbers.
Yes,
from what
exactly.
I'm hearing is the number could be 15 to 20 times the numbers that are being reported.
Exactly. But the good news is that there was a neutralization study that was done in India that does show that the current vaccines that we have are effective against this variant. India is a little bit behind the U.S. in terms of vaccine administration, and I think that is what, for me personally, is so frightening, because right now India is only administering about 2.2 million doses per day, which means that by the end of the year, only 30% of the population is potentially going to be vaccinated. And in order to vaccinate the entire population of India, we would have to increase our vaccination doses to 100 million a day, which is, an insurmountable task, in my opinion, based on the availability of the vaccine. And the vaccines that, of course, are in India are different than the ones that we have here. And well, one of them is an AstraZeneca vaccine, and then there's another one as well. Mm-hmm. I think the take home here is that there are so many things that we can do to impact and optimize our health, given the current crisis. We've already talked about a lot of them. We've talked about the importance of movement. We've talked about the importance of meditation and relaxation techniques, which will increase your immune response and enable you to, one, hopefully not get COVID, and two, if you get it, put you in a position where your body is innately able to fight it on its own. Sleep is another huge one that I feel is very commonly overlooked. When people are in panic or maybe taking care of loved ones, the last thing you do is think about yourself, right? And so you end up compromising your own health by not taking care of yourself. But the reality is that you can't take care of anyone you love if you're not taking care of yourself. So sleep is probably one of my number one recommendations, because at night when we are sleeping is when our body heals. It's when our body is going around, and think of your body as having little trash trucks and going around and collecting debris and collecting free radicals, which are damaging molecules that are both produced by our body as well as being exposed in our environment and put into our body in the form of food, right? If we're not eating proper, clean, healthy, nutritious food. And so our body has these trash trucks that essentially go around at night and collect all this debris, collect all these bad things, and take, and our liver takes a fat-soluble toxin, turns it into a water-soluble toxin that we are then able to eliminate. And a lot of this happens at night when we're sleeping. So if we're not getting, my recommendation is 7 to 9 hours of sleep is a minimum. I think honestly 8 hours is a minimum. 8 to 9 hours of uninterrupted high-quality sleep. How do you do that? There's a lot of different tips and tricks. One is no blue light, meaning no screen, no phone, 2 hours before bedtime. If you have to do it, you know, just as you can get a pulse oximeter for $20 online, very readily available, you can get blue light glasses that are also 10 to 20 bucks, and that will block blue light. Blue light is a problem because it interferes with our circadian rhythm. And it will make it very difficult for us to get into our deepest sleep cycles. Also refraining from eating 3 hours before bedtime. And it's really important also to go to bed and wake up at the same time every day, because our bodies love habit. And so sleep is another really, really important aspect of self-care. Nutrition is really, really important, right? So there's lots of superfoods that we can eat. That are going to empower our immune system. Things like, one of the most common Indian spices is turmeric, and it's amazing for your immune system. So, you know, put a little extra turmeric. Garlic is another healing food. And lots of nutrient-dense foods like dark leafy vegetables, cruciferous vegetables. One of the supplements actually that has been studied to decrease viral replication in the case of COVID is sulforaphane. And you don't have to go out and find sulforaphane. All you have to do is eat cruciferous vegetables. If you eat things like, cauliflower and broccoli, those are all cruciferous vegetables that you can naturally boost your immunity.
What about supplements? Like, people are just overloading on zinc and vitamin C. What are your recommendations around that?
Yeah, so, supplements, I think, are great, because supplements are you can fall back on them. But the reality is, everything in these supplements is found in food. So if you are eating a nutrient-dense diet, if you're eating a balanced mix of fruits and vegetables and lean protein from good sources, then you're probably going to be quite all right. Vitamin C and vitamin D are probably two of the most highly studied supplements that really do enhance our immune system and have a clinically proven role in helping with COVID. Zinc is another big one that people are commonly taking that actually works quite well. And then there's a lot of other ones that people don't think about. EGCG, for instance, is an antioxidant that is in green tea. And you can get the same amount of green tea that you would find in a supplement just by drinking like 2 or 3 cups of brewed green tea in a day. So there's a lot of ways that we can do this naturally. One of the other things I forgot to add about turmeric is that the active molecule in turmeric that boosts immunity is actually exponentially elevated in terms of its bioavailability and efficacy if black pepper is added. Mm. So make sure whenever you're cooking something with turmeric, and this is not hard to ask in India, make sure you add a little pepper, because black pepper enhances the bioavailability of the active molecule in curcumin or turmeric that is healing.
Yeah, great. That's a nice knowledge.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I think today's episode has been very beneficial because it makes us stop and think, what am I doing to take care of myself? How can I take better care of a loved one? And very importantly, don't isolate them so badly. You can go near a loved one. You can protect yourself. Can you also tell us a little bit about how to derobe, or how can you take care of a loved one and physically not isolate.
Absolutely.
That's the important aspect.
Absolutely. And that's also that's a great point. It's very well studied in the literature that social interaction causes a biochemical change in our body and is essential to healing. You know, that's the reason that communities are so emphasized in various cultures, and especially in our Indian culture, right? Community is such a big part of who we are. And so I agree. I mean, we cannot isolate, because isolation is a sure way to a downward spiral. We have to stay together, but we have to be safe when we do that. So, you know, definitely a mask, you know, and if you're concerned about, is your mask good enough, wear a double mask.
I mean, so if I'm going and taking care of a sick patient,
yeah,
I wear an N95 mask. Is that the first choice?
You don't have to wear an N95 mask, right?
Yeah, the recommendation is that, you know, this COVID-19 has a huge social implications. We have parents living in the same household, and say, for example, parents are having their elderly, their 80-year-old, they need social interactions, and let us say that somebody gets COVID, so he needs to be isolated. So what is happening is that now their isolation, they are just left for themselves. Not that I mean to say this is the nature of the disease, but there are ways that you can approach the patient, but you have to maintain highest level of precautions. And what are those? Like we do in the hospitals, we go very close to the patients. We wear a gown. It's a plastic gown. Wear a surgical mask. I would recommend wear a double surgical mask. Mm. If you have N95, this is the N95 that I'm wearing. This is N95. It gives some little difficulty in breathing by itself because it's a little tight. So if you have an N95, that's definitely good. This is the best prevention. But if you do not, use double surgical mask. But what is more important is to wear a face shield. This is a barrier, because this is a droplet infection and it spreads if somebody coughs. So these droplets goes into your mucosa and cause the cascading effect of inflammation. So wear a face shield, wear gloves. You can go close to him. Close to the patient, close to the elderly, where you they
can
need
we
help.
Go and give them a little bit of pulmonary rehab?
Absolutely,
that's
we
the other
do
thing
that.
We didn't talk about
is
avoiding a downward spiral and landing up in the ICU. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is the way we have been dealing, and that is nothing else I'm doing at least to take care of my patients. The only thing this addition is N95, and on top of that is a face shield, and I put a gown, and then when I leave the patient, then we need to disrobe it in a proper way, and then wash your hands, wash your use sanitizers, wash your stethoscope, whatever is exposed. That is very, very important. One more thing I would like to say, that you know, we do talk about surgical masks, N95. Do you know, simple things like hand washing has shown, with simple soap, if you don't have a sanitizer, hand washing has shown very good results in preventing, because you know, you need to be very careful about this area, your eyes, your nose, your mouth. This is the entry. This virus outside the human body, outside the respiratory system, is nothing. It will be killed in just 5 seconds if we use the sanitizers we use. But the sanitizers that have isopropyl alcohol above 70%, that is recommended for use. And that is perhaps, if we do these measures, we are definitely going to take a significant step in protecting ourselves.
So with disrobing, you were saying there's a special step, 1, 2, 3. Can you highlight that,
please? Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, if you are wearing a face shield, masks, gloves, and a gown, you want to disrobe in the right order. And you want to make sure that you are putting it on a surface which eventually you will disinfect. When I disrobe, the first thing I do is, you know, take off my my face shield, and I'll put it down. The mask is the last thing that comes off. You want to keep your mask on till the very end. And in between taking things off, even with your gloves on, use hand sanitizer. So take off your face shield, put it down, hand sanitize. Take off your gown, make sure that you put the inside out and dispose of it, hand sanitize again. And then take off one mask, hand sanitize again, And then finally, and then actually, I would leave the last mask on until you finish cleaning whatever you need to clean, dispose of everything you want to get rid of, and then eventually, when you're in a safe space, isolated and away from wherever you need from an infected person, then and in your house, hopefully, that's when you take off your last mask.
Well, so. Thank you so much.
Can I ask something important that I don't think we covered that. You know, certain section of the population needs definitely utmost care, because elderly 65 and above, those who are having COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, those having uncontrolled diabetes, those having underlying cancers, who are immunosuppressants, who are on immunosuppressant therapies, they need to be very, very cautious, and they need to follow highest level of precautions till this surge is going on. And what I would say, this surge is going to peak. The peak is yet to come. I'm not spreading the panic. I'm just telling you and alerting you that what to expect in coming days. And that is what has been going on for last 1 week, the numbers, the way it is going. So it demands a very highest level of precautions from all the citizens of the India, and especially the vulnerable sections of the population, that is elderly, with all the listed things I discussed, and basically using masking. Masks have shown, because it's a respiratory virus, so you need to wear a mask. Maintain social distancing, 6 feet at least. Mm-hmm. So these are the measures that everyone should practice. Stay outside the crowd. Don't assemble. Keep your rooms well ventilated. Avoid crowding. So that is really very, very important. And this message, keeping in view the current scenario and expecting few days. Now, why I'm saying, can I take 2 more minutes?
Please take your time. This is an important message.
Yes. Now, we see that the numbers are 350,000 today. Maybe, God forbid, it goes to 400,000. I mean, say under this situation, it will happen. There is a science. These are all epidemiological studies. You know, like the unit of weight is either kilo or pound. We have a unit for checking the virulence of a contagion. And that is called as R-naught. So this is for those who are well-educated, who are having scientific backgrounds. They can understand. The unit of the virulence of a contagion is R-naught. So what does R-naught mean? R-naught means that any contagion, one person, how many can it infect in the vicinity, whosoever that person has the infection, how many can it spread the infection? The more the R-naught, the more the virulence of the disease. Now, the most dreaded infectious disease in old days was measles,
right.
And its R-naught was somewhere around 15 to 18. Mm-hmm. So what it means? It means that one person of measles can spread the infection to 15 to 18 people in its vicinity and see the cascade effect. And out of those 15 to 18, everyone will spread to 15 to 18. That's how you see the numbers are piling up, Similarly, with COVID-19, as of now, still the studies are going on. I don't know the latest number of the R-naught in India currently, but apparently the studies have shown that R-naught of COVID-19 is around 3.9. It's around 3.9. Maybe the numbers are higher than that, but that means R-naught prepares all the policymakers how to anticipate the trajectory of the infection. So the R-naught, we want to keep it below 1. That means that it is contained. But once R-naught keep on piling, going high, that means how contagious the disease is. So this, I wanted to give an added information, what to expect in next few days, few months, because it's going to go up, then it will plateau, and then it will start dipping. So this is the trajectory of any pandemic, and in that process, as Dr. Lateef said, that a virus can become more virulent, it may become more passive, it may change its shape, what we call as mutations. All these things can happen in this trajectory. So this is very important to understand the concept, so that you know what are the challenges and what to do next, that will be helpful.
Thank you, thank you. I'm sure this is one of many more that we would be doing in the coming future. Breathe Easy India and Breathe Easy USA have taken it upon ourselves to spread credible information out there, because there's a lot of myths, there's a lot of panic, and we want to alleviate that. We are also starting drives to donate oxygen cylinders. We are donating oxygen plants, because in the long term and the medium term, we need to strengthen the healthcare infrastructure in India, which is collapsing. And we have 50 plants going out in the next, you know, 4 or 5 weeks. Our team is working tirelessly with all the governments, with the Indian Army. There are more plants that are going to be available in 5, 6, 8 weeks from now, maybe 12 weeks from now, which is not such a grim situation in the long term. So please do reach out to Breathe Easy India or Breathe Easy USA if you want a plant donated to a charitable hospital or a government hospital, and we will start working on that project, because we want to strengthen India, we want to strengthen the infrastructure, and to the rest of the world, this mutation can even come here. So I'm hoping that everything we spoke about today is going to help us all, and let's keep reminding ourselves, step it up, just do what we can do, at least one person at a time. So thank you so much. I know you're busy physicians. Thank you for taking time out. This has been, I've learned a lot today, by the way. I mean, learned a lot, and we have a small audience here who's learned a lot, but we have a much larger audience that has, I think they're going to find it very, very helpful today. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.